nodded. The Constitution had been designed to prevent the king riding roughshod over Parliament, but a state of war gave the monarch vast power to tackle the situation as he saw fit. It had never been tested until now. Lucas had the nasty feeling that the years after the war would see lawyers making a great deal of money, while sensitive events were rehashed time and time again. "I will be forming a war council," the king continued. "Someone will have to serve as Minister of War Production. That will be you." Lucas thought fast. His promotion would be challenged by the other dukes, he knew, although most of them were sensible enough to realize the Commonwealth needed a unified system of war production. It would test his diplomatic skills to the limit. Some of the other dukes would be unsuited to a role on his subordinate council, but would demand one in exchange for keeping their protests to a reasonable limit. Others would resent him taking a position over them and work to undermine him. It wouldn't be easy to deal with them. "But it has to be done," he thought. "We need to work in unison if we are to have any hope of winning this war." "I will be calling others over the next 2 days," the king said, breaking into Lucas's thoughts. "We will need to force forward programs to design and then construct new starships, then learn lessons from the opening moves of the war and incorporate them into our long-term development plans. Which weapons worked well in combat? Which ones need to be improved or scrapped? We will be on a very steep learning curve." "Yes, Your Majesty," Lucas said. He couldn't disagree with the logic. Besides, if he refused the post, someone else would take it. "How much authority will I have?" "Enough, I hope," the king said. "I will back you to the hilt. Just remember what will happen if we lose this war." Lucas nodded. He would be killed, of course, along with the rest of the male aristocracy. The girls and women, including his daughters, would probably be sold into slavery, or simply raped and then killed. Cat would definitely be killed. As a trained military officer, she would be deemed too dangerous to keep alive. And the factories and industrial nodes he'd spent so long building up would be used to place the entire galaxy under the yoke of the theocracy. "Yes, Your Majesty," he said. There would be other problems, he knew. The war wouldn't last forever, and when it came to an end, so would the state of emergency. Any enemies he made while gearing the Commonwealth for war would reach for their knives and try to bring him down as soon as the conflict ended. Balancing the needs of the Commonwealth with the requirements to protect his own position would be tricky. Perhaps he should just plan on stepping down as CEO as soon as the war came to an end. It might be the simplest solution. "And we will also have to hold an inquiry into how the war actually started," Lucas added. "We need to know who put Admiral Morrison out there in command of 7th Fleet." "We will leave that issue until the end of the conflict," the king said. "Right now, Your Grace, pointing fingers would be far too divisive." Lucas frowned. "Your Majesty." The king met his eyes. "We cannot risk a political catfight, not now," he said. "The charges are too serious for that to be allowed. We will leave the issue until the end of the war."
"Which will give Morrison's benefactors plenty of time to bury evidence, break a few links in the chain, and remain undiscovered," Lucas thought.
Anyone with the political clout to steer Admiral Morrison to Cadiz without revealing their involvement would have no trouble hiding their tracks in the confusion caused by the war.
But what if he's right?
No one should have been able to hide their tracks from him. Lucas knew, without false modesty, that he sat at the center of a spiderweb of clients, sub-patrons, and their clients. Almost no one should have been able to do something so thoroughly political as arrange Admiral Morrison's assignment without leaving tracks. And yet, someone had definitely succeeded well enough to keep him baffled. That alone was worrying. It suggested that Admiral Morrison's ultimate backer was one of the dukes. No one else could have hoped to pull it off. And a duke, if accused of something that was very close to treason, would be able to disrupt government for months before the matter was resolved.
"Yes, Your Majesty," he said grudgingly.
I do understand your feelings, the king assured him. But we must win first. A dull chime echoed through the room.
That will be the ambassador, the king noted.
Please stand to the side. Lucas obeyed, motioning for Sandra to join him. There was a short delay, then the theocracy's ambassador was escorted into the chamber. The last time they'd met, Lucas recalled, he'd worn neat white robes and looked surprisingly dapper. This time it was clear that he'd been thoroughly searched, and none too gently. His implants would have been deactivated before he was allowed anywhere near the royal palace.
And what? Lucas asked himself. If the ambassador is carrying something we are unable to detect.
He pushed the thought aside as the man staggered forward, escorted by two burly marines. One of them was female, Lucas noted, perhaps explaining the ambassador's clear irritation. Being manhandled was bad enough, but being manhandled by a woman would be nightmarish for a theocrat. Lucas felt a moment of pity for the ambassador's wife, a girl who stayed in the embassy and never went out onto the streets. No doubt the diplomat would take his rage out on her. Ambassador Paul, the king said, with studied nonchalance. Let me guess. You've come to apologize. Paul gave the king a furious look. This treatment is abominable, he thundered. A gross breach of diplomatic courtesy. And so is launching a war, the king said. Speak your piece and leave. The ambassador drew himself to his feet. Peace is the will of God, he said, and the theocracy has worked for peace since the one true faith was brought into being by the final prophet. But peace has been threatened again and again by the actions of your illegitimate union of worlds. You have invaded our space, incited our populations to rebellion, and sought to control the spread of the one true faith. These actions can no longer go unpunished. He took a breath. I am ordered to offer you one last chance to submit yourselves before the believers of the one true faith, he continued. You must welcome us to your worlds, surrender your ships and industries to our custody, and prepare your people to embrace the one true faith. Should you refuse, we will wage war until you are bowed in submission, ready to embrace God and take him into your hearts. There will be no further negotiation. It is submission or death. Lucas wondered absently if Paul genuinely believed his own words. It would certainly be far more convincing if he did, he knew, but it was hard to imagine anyone who had spent time on Tyre believing the crap he was spewing out. The Commonwealth hadn't supplied anyone with weapons, let alone incited them to rebel, and they hadn't even tried to ban missionaries from spreading through Commonwealth space. He winced inwardly. That would have to change. And who knew what else would be lost along with religious freedom? What would happen if all of the Commonwealth's guaranteed rights were stripped away in the name of security? How much of what his ancestors had helped build would be lost forever? The king was leaning forward angrily, but he managed to control himself before he spoke. You are correct on one point, he said. His voice was icy cold. There will be no negotiation. He took a breath. You have mounted an unprovoked war against my people, commencing with a series of cowardly terrorist attacks that have left upwards of 9,000 civilians dead. Your pathetic attempts to give us a declaration of war, too late for us to put our forces on alert, is only the icing on the cake. There will be no further negotiation, and there will be no negotiated peace. The Commonwealth will fight until the theocracy has been crushed, Ambassador, and it will be crushed. Your people want freedom? We will give it to them. Your conquests want independence? We will give it to them. Your sons want the right to learn more than how to recite your prayers by rote? We will give it to them. Your wives and daughters want the right to make their own choices? We will give it to them. And the entire galaxy wants to sleep peacefully without fearing conquest by you. We will give it to them. He met Ambassador Paul's eyes. I promise you nothing but war to the knife,
he growled sharply.
And the next time we meet, it will be when I take your surrender in the ruins of your home world.
Lucas, standing to one side, sucked in a breath. It was dangerous to drive a foe into a corner, he knew, particularly when it might be more profitable to allow them a way out. But he also knew the king spoke for his people. No one would be interested in a negotiated peace with a theocracy, not now. They'd want to crush the theocratic navy, liberate its conquests, and sow the grounds of its homeworld with salt. But the king was still speaking.
Because we are a civilized people, we will allow you and your embassy to leave peacefully, he concluded. It will no longer be necessary.
He looked at the Marines.
Get him out of my sight.
Lucas watched as the Marines escorted the ambassador out, then turned to the king.
Parliament will be behind you, he said.
He knew it to be true, despite his doubts. The attacks on Tyre had seen to that.
But should we not offer them their lives?
The king waved a hand towards the window, where plumes of smoke could still be seen.
No one will want mercy, Your Grace, he said.
His voice was very dark as he surveyed the scene before him. He turned to face Lucas.
9,000 civilians, perhaps more, are dead, killed by the vilest treachery. There can be no mercy to a government that considers such sneak attacks a legitimate way of opening the war, and I will offer none.
He looked down at the hard marble floor, then up at Lucas.
Prepare yourself for your new responsibilities, he ordered. Our forces will need everything from starships to armored combat suits and rations. You will be charged with meeting their demands, and you will be advising me on the course of the war.
Yes, Your Majesty, Lucas said.
There was no choice. It was him or someone else, someone who might be less invested in victory.
It will be my honor.
The king nodded.
I think we shall offer the ambassador's family the chance to remain, he added.
He smiled brilliantly.
And his servants, too. Wouldn't that make their lives more interesting?
Lucas frowned.
Why, Your Majesty?
The Princess Drusilla is also on her way here, the king said. We could find a use for her, I'm sure. And we could find a use for our ambassador's family, too.
Chapter 34
No sign of pursuit, Captain, Roach reported. Hyperspace is clear.
Cat let out a sigh of relief. An engagement in hyperspace might have allowed them a chance to reverse the outcome of the battle, but it might also have proven disastrous. Two or three antimatter warheads would have started an energy storm that would have seriously threatened both sides. Trying to raise a storm near the enemy fleet would have seemed a workable idea if she hadn't been certain she would risk her own ships, too.
And will it seem a viable weapon of war in the future? She asked herself. Or will both sides refrain from using it for fear of the consequences?
Stand down from battle stations, she ordered. The red lights dimmed. Damage report?
No major damage, Lin reported.
The engineer sounded relieved.
We lost a pair of shield generators which will need to be replaced, but the remainder are intact.
Thank God, Cat said. She turned to the XO. And the fleet?
Battered, the XO reported. 9 super dreadnoughts are gone. 4 more are almost certainly not going to be combat capable without yard time. The remainder of the super dreadnoughts have damage ranging from minor to several weeks of repair work.
Cat sighed. Can we do any repair work in transit?
We'll have to shuttle engineering crews round the fleet, the XO said. But we're still doing headcounts. We don't even have an accurate idea how many people we have on the ships, Captain. And we certainly don't have an inventory of spare parts.
If Admiral Morrison isn't dead, Cat thought, I'm going to kill him personally.
She looked at the display for a long moment. 2 squadrons of super dreadnoughts and 37 other starships were nothing to sniff at. By any reasonable standard, she was the youngest fleet commander in history, although she knew she wouldn't be allowed to keep the fleet.
She didn't have a dedicated command ship, for one thing. But it would have been a high point of her career if the ships hadn't been so badly damaged. It would be a long time before Seventh Fleet was combat-capable again.
We might just break up the formation and assign the usable ships to other fleets, she thought morbidly. I don't think anyone will care.
Complete the headcount, then work through the engineering reports, she ordered. She wasn't trained for fleet command. What if she missed something? Shuttle engineering crews round the fleet, concentrating on the ships that can be returned to operational status sooner rather than later. If a ship needs yard time, leave a skeleton crew and get the rest somewhere where they can be more useful.
Aye, Captain, the XO said. Doing it under transit will prove a challenge.
Cat nodded. But do we have a choice? She thought fast. Her father's brief update had stated that Admiral Christian and Sixth Fleet had been ordered to Gamma Base, a star 40 light-years from Cadiz. But she hadn't heard anything since then, and there was no way to tell if the fleet had already reached its destination, or if it was still in transit. It might not matter, she told herself. Her first duty was to report to the Admiralty, and Gamma Base had a working Starcom.
Or it should have had a working Starcom, part of her mind noted. What if the Theocracy got there, too?
She dismissed the thought, then looked at the display. The 67th Destroyer Squadron is largely intact, she said. Reassign two more destroyers to fill the holes in the squadron's roster, then order her CO to return to Cadiz. They are to monitor the star system at a safe distance and, if possible, attempt to open communications with forces on the ground.
Aye, Captain, the XO said.
He paused, then opened a private channel to Cat.
Captain, it is unlikely they will be able to get close enough to the planet to open a secure channel to anyone.
I know, Cat sent back. She thought briefly of the millions of crowns invested in Cadiz by various corporations, including her own. The Theocracy had gained a valuable prize when it overran the system. There had been no time to rig the facilities to self-destruct. But we have to try. She settled back in her command chair, feeling very tired. It was her first major engagement, and all she'd been able to do was run. And she was already tired of running. Part of her wanted to lurk on the edge of the system until her fleet was ready, then go on the offensive, but she knew it wasn't possible. They didn't have any supply dumps closer than Gamma Base. Admiral Morrison should have had pre-positioned stockpiles along the border. That he hadn't, Cat knew, was yet another sign of criminal incompetence.
Or outright treason, she thought. But was that really possible?
Set course for Gamma Base, she ordered the helmsman. Best possible speed.
Aye, Captain, Weiberg said. We'll be there in 4 days.
Prepare to detach a destroyer to run ahead of us. Cat ordered the XO. She can take our reports to the Starcom.
Aye, Captain, the XO said. But it will only shave a day off our time before we can report in.
It doesn't matter, Cat said. By now, someone would surely have noticed that they lost contact with Cadiz. All Starcom shutdowns should be notified in advance. Someone would surely draw the correct conclusion and alert the Commonwealth that it was at war with the Theocracy. But what if someone hadn't drawn the correct conclusion? Or what if something else had gone badly wrong? We need to get our report out as quickly as possible. She rose to her feet, feeling almost too tired to walk. I'll write the report now, she said. You have the bridge.
Aye, Captain, the XO said. I have the bridge.
Cat stepped into her ready room and closed the hatch behind her, then sagged onto the sofa and put her head in her hands. She'd failed, she told herself, as despair threatened to overcome her. Her father had expected her to gather proof the war was about to begin and galvanize the Admiral into action. But she'd barely succeeded at the former and failed completely at the latter. And the end run they'd done round Morrison and his ass-kissing subordinates hadn't been enough to save the fleet. They'd had no choice but to flee.
We made it out, she told herself.
The fleet might have made it out, but it had been too badly battered to be considered combat-capable any longer. We could have lost everything. And she had lost Davidson. She cursed herself angrily, first for pulling him back into her bed, and then for sending him to Cadiz.
He could have called General Eastside from orbit, and to hell with Marine protocol.
It was easy to imagine him dead now. His shuttle slammed into the ground, his body lying in a ditch. Or him having been taken prisoner by the theocracy. She knew what they'd do to a trained Marine. She had loved him once. She still cared deeply for him. And she had sent him to his death.
"You're too young," a voice whispered in the back of her head. "You're too unpolished to be put in command of a heavy cruiser, let alone a fleet." "And stop whining, you stupid bitch," another voice said. "However you got it, you're in command. You have a responsibility you cannot shirk. Or are you going to cower in your ready room like a stupid little girl and leave the officers under your command without orders? And prove that everyone who had doubts about you was right all along?"
Angrily, she pulled herself to her feet and looked in the mirror. She looked awful, despite the genetic engineering that had gone into her body. Her hair was soaked with sweat, her uniform clung to her in awkward places, and her face looked tired and worn. She wanted to shower, then sleep for a week. Instead, she walked into the washroom, splashed water on her face, and then returned to her desk. She had a report to write.
"And hope it doesn't get me shot out of hand," she thought.
She was the fleet commander now, at least until a senior officer was assigned to the fleet. There was no way her father's influence could save her from a board of inquiry, and if she was found responsible for the disaster, she might well lose her career at the very least.
Shaking her head, she reached for the terminal and started to work.
"It is my duty," Dr. Bram said, as William entered the compartment, "to warn you that sickbay is critically low on personnel."
"Duly noted, doctor," William said.
He'd ordered 2/3 of her staff reassigned to the super dreadnoughts. Over 500 crewmen had been injured, and the headcount had yet to be completed. Several of them would have to be shoved into stasis until the fleet reached safe haven.
"Get back to work."
"Aye, commander," the doctor said tartly. "However, regulations clearly state—"
"The regulations were written in peacetime," William snapped.
They were clear. Among other things, a vessel's senior medical officer was not to leave her ship without the captain's direct permission, while her complement of medical crew was not to be reduced by more than 1/3.
"This is war."
He sucked in a breath. How the hell had Fran's late, unlamented commanding officer managed to get away with sending over half of his medical complement on leave at the same time? The fleet had been in orbit, with little real chance of disaster. But it should still have been a court-martial offense. Or had someone merely decided there was no point in trying to bring charges against one of Admiral Morrison's cronies?
"Yes," the doctor said. "But—"
"But nothing," William said.
He'd expected better from her.
"Those are your orders, doctor, which you may have in writing if you wish. We do not have the medical complement on each ship to avoid breaking regulations."
He watched her storm off, then turned back to the endless stream of reports. Admiral Morrison had done a good job of suppressing initiative, too, he noted. William was being asked to approve matters that should, by rights, have been handled by local officers. He should have told them to promote themselves to captains as long as they were in command of starships, but it was unlikely they'd accept such orders. It was certainly unlikely he had authority to issue them.
"But they're in command now," he thought sourly. "They should be captains."
He pushed the thought aside as he reviewed the first after-action report. Most of Seventh Fleet's deficiencies were hardly news to him, but there were a few interesting points. Notably, the shield generators had been out of harmony on several super-dreadnoughts, weakening their shields under the onslaught from the gunboats. Missile hits that should have been shrugged off had done real damage to starships that not only cost far more than a single gunboat, but took much longer to produce. He read the rest of the report, then dropped a copy in his private subsection of the datanet.
If there was an attempt to whitewash Admiral Morrison in the wake of his presumed death, William was damned if he was going to let it succeed. A few independent media outlets would be very interested in the files.
Commander, Roach said, I have a detailed tactical report of our performance as a fleet command ship. Shit awful, William snapped.
He forced himself to calm his temper with an effort. It was hardly Roach's fault that the battle had gone so badly. Hell, it couldn't be blamed on the captain either, although she'd issued the order to retreat.
How badly did we do?
Not as badly as I thought, Roach said. We did manage to organize a tactical withdrawal under fire.
Call it a retreat, William said.
It was a tricky maneuver to pull off under fire, he knew, but fancy words didn't change the fact they'd lost and left the enemy in possession of their target.
Or would you like to come up with a suitably stupid term for surrender?
He felt a moment of pain for the captain. William was far from blind, and it was alarmingly clear, at least to him, that the captain and her Marine CO had been lovers once upon a time. They'd certainly served together on an earlier ship. But they had been professional, at least in public, and she hadn't hesitated to send him to Cadiz, where he was missing, presumed dead. They didn't even know if he'd managed to land at the spaceport before it had been overrun and destroyed.
She's too young, he thought.
The captain didn't have the seasoning to handle losing someone so close to her, not in a situation where she could blame herself for his death. And she certainly would. Unlike far too many aristocrats, she was aware of crewmen and officers as people, not things to be moved round on her own personal chessboard. He stared down at his console, trying to decide what to do. But he knew there was nothing he could say. Roach coughed.
Commander?
William scowled. Roach had been speaking and he hadn't heard a word.
Say that again, he said. I was hundreds of light years away.
Yes, sir,
Roach said.
The other piece of tactical information we picked up is that their data net leaks.
William leaned forward.
It leaks?
Yes, sir, Roach said. They seem to use tight beam radio as well as lasers to maintain the data net. I don't think they entirely trust their laser links.
Odd, William said.
There were several reasons why maintaining laser links over a vast distance was difficult, but none of them should have applied to a fleet operating in formation.
Do you have any idea why?
No, sir, Roach said. But it does give us an opportunity to ID the command ship. There will always be some backwash from the radio transmissions.
Difficult to spot in a firefight,
William pointed out. He shrugged.
See if you can devise a program for identifying their command structure. Then run it through simulations and see how it might work in practice. If it works, we would know which ships to target in a major fleet engagement.
Assuming they don't use a staggered command structure, Roach said. We certainly do.
It's a possibility, William agreed.
There had been no shortage of experimental programs intended to track and decode enemy signals during a battle, but none of them had ever worked in practice. Or at least, they hadn't provided actionable intelligence.
See what you can pull out of the records.
He watched Roach go, then turned back to his console. Maybe it would work in practice. Certainly there had been odder theories that had actually produced workable hardware. But he knew better than to count on any silver bullet to win the war. It would be won by super dreadnoughts and battlecruisers, missiles, bullets, and beams. And the Theocracy had already scored a significant victory. Shaking his head, he went back to work. 4 days passed slowly. Slowly enough for Cat to tour several of the super dreadnoughts and meet the men and women under her command. None of them looked anything other than tired. They were working double shifts, just trying to get the ships back into service before the Theocracy caught up with them. Cat did what she could to help, even to the point of cannibalizing components from the yard-bound vessels. But it wasn't enough. She was feeling the stress again by the time the fleet finally opened a series of vortexes and returned to real space in the Gamma system, well away from the naval base. Send an IFF signal,
Cat ordered, once she was satisfied there was no one waiting in ambush. The thought of the theocracy striking so far behind the lines had kept her awake at nights.
And then link into the local Starcom. Send a copy of our report to Tyre.
Aye, Captain, Ross said.
I'm picking up multiple capital ships, Roach reported. Several are definitely super dreadnoughts.
Cat felt her blood run cold. Had they been outraced by the enemy ships?
IFF signals are Commonwealth. I say again, IFF signals are Commonwealth, Ross said.
They're the Sixth Fleet.
Thank God, the XO said.
Cat nodded. The Sixth Fleet had an admiral of its own. She wouldn't be fleet commander any longer. It was odd, but she couldn't help feeling relieved.
Transmit a full copy of our report, Cat said.
The destroyer would already have alerted Sixth Fleet, but they hadn't had an up-to-date report.
And then request a status report from their CO. If they have a fleet train handy, hit them with our shopping list. I want every ship in the fleet to draw on the facilities until they are combat-capable again.
There was a long pause.
Captain, Ross said, you are ordered to report to Admiral Christian on the Thunderchild.
Cat sucked in her breath.
Understood, she said.
It was unfortunate that there would be no time to freshen up before she reported to the Admiral.
Inform him that I am on my way.
She keyed her console, ordering her shuttle to be powered up, then rose.
Mr. XO, you have the bridge.
Aye, Captain, the XO said.
His eyes were worried. Worried for her.
I have the bridge.
Cat glanced from console to console, wondering if it was the last time she would set eyes on it, then picked up her terminal and walked through the hatch, refusing to look back. If the Admiral relieved her of command,
you got the fleet out, she told herself firmly. And that's all that matters.
Chapter 35. The walk from the shuttle airlock to Admiral Christian's private compartment felt hundreds of miles long, as though Cat was heading to her own execution. It was terrifyingly clear that Thunderchild was a happy ship, with a capable commander and crew that worked hard for their officers. Compared to the remains of Seventh Fleet, she was magnificent. Cat couldn't help feeling a twinge of envy as she stopped in front of a hatch, then knocked. It opened a moment later, inviting her inside.
Captain Falcone, Admiral Gareth Christian said. Thank you for coming.
Admiral, Cat said tersely. He motioned for her to take a seat. Cat sat, studying him carefully. Compared to Admiral Morrison, he looked ugly as hell. His face resembled nothing so much as a bulldog, complete with an expression that suggested he was damned if he was letting go of anything in his mouth. Cat found it oddly reassuring. The Admiral didn't seem to feel the urge to use cosmetic surgery to beautify himself. It suggested he had few doubts about his own performance.
I read the report you sent ahead, Christian said without preamble. Is there anything you wish to add to your report?
No, sir. Cat said.
She'd written as cold and impersonal an account as she could. The only moment she'd allowed her feelings to show through had been when she took full responsibility for going behind Admiral Morrison's back. Commander Higgins and her fellows didn't have the political clout to escape charges of mutiny.
It is complete.
And it seems that Seventh Fleet would not have survived were it not for you,
Christian added.
You pulled two squadrons of super dreadnoughts out of a fire that could easily have consumed them.
Yes, sir, Cat said.
It is my considered opinion that Cadiz was beyond saving,
Christian said calmly.
Do you agree with this judgment?
I do, Cat said simply.
I have informed Tyre that you did the best you could under the circumstances,
Christian said.
You were not to blame for the lack of preparation, the incompetence of a number of superior officers, and the general condition of the fleet. I do not believe that anyone will seek to hold you to account for disaster.
Thank you, sir, Cat said.
She let out a long breath. Logically, she'd known she couldn't be blamed. Emotionally, she knew she would always wonder if there had been something else she could have done.
Self-doubt is understandable under such circumstances,
Christian said, cutting her off.
I do not feel it is justified, though. You did better than anyone had any right to expect.
He straightened up, resting his hands on his lap.
And with that out the way,
he said,
I need a full rundown on Seventh Fleet.
Cat took a breath. We have roughly one squadron of super dreadnoughts that can fly and fight, she said. The remainder need heavy time in the yards before they can be recommitted to battle. Thankfully, the smaller ships took less of a beating, but several of them also require yard time. She produced a data chip from her pocket. This is the full report, sir, she added. But a number of the ships used creative editing.
As always,
Christian observed. Cat felt her cheeks heat. She'd made the mistake of taking the original set of reports at face value. It had been her XO who'd pointed out that several of the officers had written the reports very carefully, suggesting their ships were ready to return to the fight, even though they needed several weeks in the hands of repair crews. At least, he'd pointed out afterwards, it suggested the crews were ready to fight. The Seventh Fleet couldn't allow itself to fall into despair. Yes, sir, she said.
There were a number of attacks inside the Commonwealth itself,
Christian continued grimly.
Most of them were terrorist attacks, but a handful were considerably more serious, involving pre-positioned warships. Right now we have a declaration of war and a public ready to burn the theocracy's worlds to ash and sow the ground with salt. But the political and military leadership has yet to determine a strategy. Our morale will plummet when news of Cadiz leaks out, and it will.
He took a breath.
We cannot allow morale to fall too far, he explained. I therefore intend to give the public a victory.
Cat hesitated. Admiral Christian's fleet was the sole intact formation for 50 light years. It would take time to move reinforcements to the front lines, which would give the theocracy a decisive advantage if they managed to take out Sixth Fleet and the remains of Seventh Fleet. And the politicians would probably hesitate to ship reinforcements forward, knowing there would be public protest at the thought of being left undefended. Only a few Commonwealth worlds could hope to stave off a theocratic offensive without support from the Royal Navy. A victory, she repeated. You expect them to attack here?
I'm not sure they know we're here, Admiral Christian observed. The Seventh Fleet was meant to avoid provocations, after all, and reinforcing the border would definitely count as a provocation.
He snorted rudely.
But it does give us a limited advantage, he added. We can take the offensive and give them a bloody nose.
Christian tapped a switch. A holographic image of the Cadiz system appeared in front of them. It split in two a moment later, one showing Cadiz, the other showing the unnamed star the theocracy had used as a staging base. The Admiral's analysts had been hard at work, Cat saw, as new icons and notes flashed up on the display. It was clear that the fleet she'd seen preparing for the assault had been the one that had attacked Cadiz. She shook her head, as if there had been any doubt.
This is the enemy attack fleet, Christian said. It is powerful, no doubt about that, and it is well trained. But there's something missing.
Cat studied the display for a long moment. She'd hoped the theocracy would be inferior to the Commonwealth. But no great deficiencies had shown themselves when the two sides had finally come to blows. And somehow she doubted the three squadrons of enemy super-dreadnoughts were all they possessed. The Royal Navy deployed over 100 super-dreadnoughts. And then she saw it. A fleet train, she said. They don't have any supply ships.
Precisely, Admiral Christian said.
But they could have remained powered down, Cat objected, playing devil's advocate. Or they might have been hidden in hyperspace.
By any reasonable standard, Admiral Christian observed, the theocracy should have begun its attacks earlier. The curiously staggered timing of the attacks deeper within the Commonwealth suggests that they were caught on the hop.
Because of us, Cat said bitterly. Admiral Christian pointed a long finger at her.
It was not your fault, he said. But you probably encouraged them to launch the attack ahead of schedule, and that begs the question of precisely why they didn't launch the attack earlier. Could it be they don't have the fleet train to support their advance?
Cat considered it thoughtfully. The XO's brother had been pretty clear that the smugglers were being hired to ship goods inside the theocracy, rather than just sneaking forbidden goods past the guardships. And everything they knew about the theocracy suggested it had a command economy. Someone in charge of shaping industrial and military growth might well have concentrated on super dreadnoughts and other warships instead of freighters, even though support craft would be vitally important if the theocracy went on the offensive. It's possible, she said. But her father's warning rang through her head. There was no lie or false conclusion so dangerous as the one you wanted to believe. But they could have just kept the freighters back, out of danger. We wouldn't fly a freighter convoy into a battle zone.
No, we wouldn't, Admiral Christian agreed. But did they have any reason to believe we would fly a spy ship into their staging base?
No, Cat said slowly. The theocracy hadn't had to worry about spy ships. Even if they had, none of them would have visited the unnamed system. They would have concentrated on inhabited worlds. You're suggesting they don't have their fleet train ready to support their advance. It sounded possible, she knew, but was that because she wanted to believe it?
There are three reasons to launch a counterattack as quickly as possible, Admiral Christian said. First, we need to give them a bloody nose, both to teach them caution and convince our own people that we can and will fight back. Second, we need to recover our personnel on Cadiz itself. And third, we need to destroy the facilities within the system. They cannot be allowed to support the theocracy's advance.
Cat looked down at the deck. I'm sorry, she mumbled, feeling like a schoolgirl who had been called on the carpet. There was no time to plan their destruction.
Admiral fucking Morrison should have planned for the worst, Admiral Christian snapped. And once the war is over, I will do everything in my power to make sure his backers are rooted out and put on trial for leaving him in command of the system. It wasn't your responsibility to sabotage the facilities, Captain, and no one will blame you for not realizing it needed to be done in time. But it does leave us with a headache.
And another good reason not to discuss his plans openly with the Admiralty, Cat thought sourly. The corporations that build the facilities might object to their destruction.
The Sixth Fleet, and intact units from Seventh Fleet, will advance to the edge of Cadiz, Admiral Christian said. We will contact the destroyers you left watching the system, good thinking, by the way, and determine the status of the enemy fleet. If it has been rearmed and repaired, we will engage at long range and do some damage before buggering off. If not, we'll seek a decisive battle.
Cat swallowed. The pre-war naval planners had considered destroying the enemy's fleet to be the first objective of any military operation. God knew there was no sign the theocracy disagreed. By dangling Sixth Fleet in front of the enemy commander, Admiral Christian would be offering him a chance to win the war in a single afternoon. Or lose it. And if the enemy won the ensuing battle... Admiral Christian altered the display, focusing, once again, on Cadiz.
We will advance toward Cadiz 7, he continued. The facilities in orbit around the gas giant will be our main target. If possible, we will recover personnel before we blow the facilities, but those facilities will be blown. The enemy will have to decide between trying to stop us from attacking the facilities or leaving them to be destroyed.
He grinned at her.
You and your squadron will remain in hyperspace, he added. If the enemy fleet advances to engage us, you will come out of hyperspace behind the enemy and attack Cadiz itself. You will destroy enemy facilities on the ground, then attempt to pick up as many of our personnel as possible, then retreat back into hyperspace.
Cat worked her way through the details slowly. It sounds as if there's too much that can go wrong, she said. What if the enemy fleet doubles back to engage me?
Then you run,
Admiral Christian said bluntly.
but I don't expect them to pass up the chance of destroying Sixth Fleet. Or, for that matter, to allow us to blow the facilities without opposition, not when they need them so badly.
He shrugged.
I don't intend to try to hold Cadiz permanently, he added. The Theocracy will already have reinforcements on the way. All I want to do is get in, smash the facilities, and then get out again. If it seems likely we can win a duel with the enemy fleet, we'll seek battle. But we cannot afford heavy losses.
Cat nodded. There was no way to know what percentage of the Theocracy's total fleet had attacked Cadiz. 29 super dreadnoughts. Were they 10% of the enemy fleet, 20%, or 50%? There was no way to know. And it would be weeks, perhaps months, before additional forces were surged forward to reinforce the front lines. She couldn't argue with his logic. The Royal Navy couldn't afford catastrophic losses. You were wrong, sir, she mumbled. I could have done something. Admiral Christian quirked an eyebrow.
You could?
I could have killed him, Cat said. She recalled the insurgent attack on the Admiral's mansion. If she'd known just how badly the battle would have gone, she would have sneaked out of the mansion and called for pickup when she was well away from the terrorists, leaving them to kill the Admiral at leisure. Or she could just have shot him herself.
Sir, shooting one's senior officers is hardly the sort of behavior the Royal Navy wishes to encourage,
Admiral Christian said mildly.
Your career would have been utterly destroyed, and you would probably have spent the rest of your life in prison if your father managed to save you from the firing squad.
20,000 officers and crew are dead, Cat pointed out bitterly. There were hundreds of thousands of soldiers in the occupation force. They're dead. God alone knows how many civilians are dead on Cadiz or wishing they're dead if the Theocracy has clamped down on the locals. My life would be a small price to pay to keep them alive. Admiral Christian reached out and rested his hand on her shoulder.
You can't change the past, he said. All you can do is learn from it.
Yes, sir, Cat said.
And I will personally kill the next incompetent officer I encounter. I fear war will winnow them out soon enough, Admiral Christian said. And I would suggest you keep such sentiments to yourself in the future.
Cat nodded reluctantly. But she had no intention of forgetting her private vow. Her crew, her superiors, all of them had feared she was incompetent. Someone who had only gained her command through family connections. They'd probably had nightmares about her costing them their lives through a simple mistake, one a more experienced officer would have avoided. And yet, Admiral Morrison had been far too like her for comfort. Powerful patrons had put him in command. Powerful patrons had prevented any investigation that would have led to his removal. She was damned if she was allowing it to happen again. Her career, even her life, was a small price to pay for preventing another disaster on the same scale.
Return to your ship,
Admiral Christian ordered gently, breaking into her thoughts.
I'll forward the operational plans to you as soon as possible. Then assume command of the remains of Seventh Fleet.
Yes, sir, Cat said. She took a breath. The officers in command of the ships should be formally promoted to captains.
Admiral Christian gave her a long look. Is there a reason for that?
Cat felt her temper flare, then forced it down. Yes, sir, she said instead. They chose to work in secret to prepare the fleet to fight, despite Admiral Morrison's orders. I believe they showed considerable moral courage in accepting the risk of losing their careers if the Admiral found out before it was too late. And they managed to get their ships out of the enemy trap. I do not believe they should be pushed back purely because someone else has a better pedigree than themselves.
I see, Admiral Christian said. And you believe I should use my authority to make the ranks they've assumed permanent?
Yes, sir, Cat said. She held his eyes. I do.
Very well, the Admiral said. There won't be a formal ceremony, of course, but they will be promoted. I'll register it in the logbook today.
Cat allowed herself a moment of relief. Commander Fran Higgins and her comrades couldn't be stripped of their ranks now. At least not without doing something to justify a court-martial and formal punishment. They deserved command. Far more than anyone who had sat out the battle on Cadiz. And she was confident they would make good commanding officers. They already knew what to avoid. And besides, she thought, no one could blame them for preparing the fleet, not now. Admiral Christian rose to his feet.
Return to your ship, he ordered. I'll assign ships to your command as soon as possible. Start carrying out drills right away, Captain. We will return to Cadiz within the week.
Yes, sir, Kat said. It wasn't long enough to do more than basic drills, but at least she would have more to work with than the super dreadnoughts. Her crews were better trained for a start.
I won't let you down.
And you might want to pen a private note to your father, Admiral Christian added. There was an oddly amused note to his voice.
I believe he has been worrying about you.
Everyone will have a chance to write a private note, Kat said firmly. She wasn't going to be the only one allowed to send a message home, even though her father had enough influence to make it happen.
The Starcom can handle the traffic, sir.
The Admiral smiled.
Of course it can, he said. But censorship rules are already in effect. You might want to warn your crews to be careful what they say.
Yes, sir, Kat said. She looked up at the display. The theocracy might already be sending fleets deeper into Commonwealth space.
But the folks at home will know the worst soon enough. I know, Admiral Christian said. That's why I want to give them a morale-boosting victory as soon as possible. It won't be long before the full truth leaks out. And then the shit will definitely hit the fan.
Chapter 36 The village wasn't very large, Davidson noted, as Jess led him to a place where they could watch from a safe distance. It was really nothing more than a dozen mid-sized houses, one large church, and a handful of shops, all surrounded by farms. He had a feeling that it had been largely ignored during the Commonwealth's occupation of Cadiz, something that would have suited the locals just fine. They had more important things to do than wage war on the occupation force.
Several of our leaders answered calls to meet with theocratic representatives, Jess explained as they made themselves comfortable. None of them have been seen since.
Davidson wasn't surprised.
They probably knew precisely who to round up, he said. If they supplied you with weapons, they knew who took them. Hell, they might even have outfitted trackers in the weapons themselves.
Jess looked grim.
Several bases went silent, she added. Mine survived. Is that because I didn't have any of their weapons in the base?
Perhaps, Davidson said. If the theocracy had had agents on the surface, making contact with the insurgents, they could have been quietly gathering information for years.
Do you believe us now?
We haven't heard anything from inside the city, Jess admitted. They've sealed the place off better than you bastards managed to.
None of our people have managed to get in or out of the Ring of Steel.
Davidson gave her a long look.
That doesn't answer my question, he said. Do you believe me now?
I think we have little reason to trust either of you, Jess said.
She paused, then nodded as a line of vehicles came into view.
And here they come.
Davidson activated his ocular implants as the ground forces approached the village. They were led by a small tank bristling with weapons, designed more for crowd control than armored warfare. Behind the tank were five trucks crammed with armed soldiers wearing khaki combat outfits. They all looked grimly determined and alert. Clearly, their commander expected trouble. At the rear was another tank watching for signs of trouble. Davidson hoped that no one in the village was inclined to put up a fight. The convoy stopped at the edge of town, the soldiers dismounting and spreading out until they had sealed the entire village. Davidson caught sight of a handful of men and women trying to flee into the countryside, only to be caught, brutally beaten with rifle butts, and then forced back into the village. As soon as the area was closed off, the soldiers entered, bellowing orders for the inhabitants to assemble. Fearfully, the locals obeyed. Jess elbowed him.
What are they doing?
Looking for weapons, Davidson muttered back. The soldiers were searching the buildings one by one. They were practiced. Practiced enough to convince him they'd searched for arms many times before. A number of primitive rifles were found and tossed out onto the streets, but little else. Once they've rendered the village defenseless, they will lay down the law. He watched grimly as the search came to an end, and the leader started to address the villagers. It was impossible to hear what the enemy commander was saying to the locals from their distance, but he could guess. They would be expected to provide a certain amount of tribute every year, to respect theocratic law, and report on any insurgent movements within their territory. At the end of his speech, the soldiers snatched a handful of children, girls and boys, and dragged them to their vehicles. Anyone who dared object was simply knocked down by the soldiers and beaten into a bloody mass. Hostages, Patrick thought. They'll be taking hostages to ensure the villagers behave themselves.
Bastards,
Jess hissed.
Now we won't be able to rely on the villagers.
No, Patrick agreed.
And there's more.
Having restored order, the soldiers were registering the remaining villagers, entering their details into their computer network. Patrick knew what that meant, all right. If any of the villagers turned insurgent, their bodies might be recovered and their home identified. The theocracy would then take a terrible revenge on their families. So far, everything matched what they'd been told by the refugees. Jess looked at him.
Most of my people won't be registered, she said.
They won't be able to track down their families.
They might, Davidson said. If someone unregistered is run through the system, it still might be able to identify their parents or children.
And then the theocracy will hunt them down. He watched, unsurprised, as ID cards were handed out. It was easy to guess what the soldiers were saying. Anyone caught without an ID card would be arrested, perhaps detained permanently. And anyone caught well away from their village, ID card or not, would face some tough questioning before they were released. If they were released. The theocracy was fond of enslaving diehard resistance fighters and working them to death.
They're leaving, Jess said softly. And they're taking the hostages with them.
We need to track down their forward operating base, Davidson said. The soldiers climbed into their vehicles and drove away without looking back. And then we can plan a rescue. The two slipped away as soon as the enemy vehicles were out of sight, making their way back into the forest and heading towards the insurgent base. Jess said nothing as they walked, her expression pensive. Davidson found it hard to blame her. She'd spent half her life waging war on one opponent, only to discover she and her men had been played for fools by another, far more powerful enemy, one that would seek to utterly destroy their way of life.
I know how you feel, Davidson admitted, just to break the silence. There were Marines who worried about what the Commonwealth would do to their homeworlds.
Jess glared at him.
And what did you do to their homeworlds?
Nothing, Patrick said. But they were afraid our influence would contaminate their way of life.
And that's precisely what you did here, Jess said.
And now the theocracy is doing the same. She muttered something unpleasant under her breath, and then kept walking until they reached the tiny camp. Davidson took one look. It was the first time he had visited the camp, and silently prayed it was only a satellite base rather than the main insurgent complex for the region. It didn't look very impressive, even under the forest's canopy. A handful of men were seated there, waiting for them.
It isn't good, Jess said, and briefly outlined what they'd seen. The noose is tightening.
It's worse,
a tall, dark-skinned man said.
We got a runner from Gibraltar.
Davidson felt his eyes narrow in suspicion.
Did you search him carefully?
Of course we did,
the speaker said.
We're not stupid.
Bring him forward, Jess ordered. Let us hear what he has to say.
Davidson watched grimly as the young man, his hands bound behind his back and his eyes blindfolded, was brought out. There were no obvious signs of torture, yet there was something in the way the runner held himself that suggested he knew he was damned.